Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. Why can't we get the rotten apples out of Parliament? After a week of scandals and revelations, it's shocking that MPs can do so much wrong and yet hold on to their seats for another 2 years. So we're discussing how to get rid of them. And child porn, is it really natural to be curious enough to click on it? And can the government really clean it off the internet? I'm joined in the studio by Tory MP Douglas Carswell, The Telegraph's Whitehall guru Sue Cameron, Jake Wallace-Simons, a novelist and Telegraph features writer, and Willard Foxton, an investigative journalist and TV producer. How appropriate it is that this week marks the 50th anniversary of the Perfumer affair. In the past few days, the Tory MP Patrick Mercer has been accused of abusing his position by tabling parliamentary questions and motions in exchange for cash. And the Lib Dem MP Mike Hancock has quit the party whip while he fights allegations of sexual assault. Meanwhile, Labour MP Eric Joyce has effectively admitted that his career in Parliament is over after getting a 12-month community order and a £3,000 fine after assaulting someone in the House of Commons bar. It's surely not right that these people can continue to sit in Parliament, yet David Cameron doesn't seem interested in doing everything he can to get rid of them. So I'm going to talk to Douglas Carswell and Sue Cameron about what can be done and, just as importantly, why politics seems to attract such sleazebags in the first place. Douglas, you're in favour of recalling MPs, aren't you? But do you sense that the government is listening?
It's depressing, isn't it? After the MPs' expense scandal, so vividly exposed by this newspaper, we got promises from all parties to introduce a right of recall, that is to give ordinary voters the right to sack MPs and to say, you know, I'm sorry, you haven't lived up to our expectations. But where is it? What's happened to it? The initial attempt fizzled out. After the latest set of scandals, it's been dusted off. But if you study the small print, the government's proposing a recall mechanism without an actual recall vote. What they're suggesting is that a committee of grandees in Westminster, just the sort of people, incidentally, who are supposed to be policing MPs' behaviour as it is, would decide whether or not an MP should be removed from the House of Commons. At no point under the government's proposals will the majority opinion in a constituency be allowed to express an opinion. These are the sorts of powers that I think Charles II would love to have had, and yet we see a so-called modernising reformist government trying to implement them. You know, it's at weeks like this I really do miss Steve Hilton.
Why? I'm somewhat confused about that point, because I thought the Prime Minister said that if someone had been censured by the House, that could trigger the opportunity for a recall. So does that mean that the people are not involved in the process?
Let's be absolutely. I asked him this question at Prime Minister's Questions this week, and he said that if the committee in Westminster, the Standards and Privileges Committee, censured an MP, there would be a recall. Not correct. What there would be is, under his scheme, there would be a mechanism whereby 1 in 10 constituents could sign a petition that would remove that MP. That is not a recall vote. A recall vote is a ballot in a constituency that says to every voter, would you like your Member of Parliament to be recalled, yes or no? That is a recall vote. What
okay.
They're proposing is something very, very different to it.
So when the Prime Minister says that there is some sort of recall mechanism, is he confused, do you think, about what that means, or is he actually deliberately misleading people?
I think regrettably confused. I think sometimes in politics the urgent squeezes out the important, and if you have lots of urgent business to attend to as someone with executive power, perhaps you're not always surrounded by policy advisors who quite grasp the detail.
Sue Cameron, do you think the government's doing enough? What more can it do?
Well, I think I agree with Douglas that often the urgent squeezes out pretty much everything else. But I'm pretty confused as to exactly what's meant to happen under the new system if they bring it in. And it does seem to me that this whole area is fraught with all sorts of difficulties. First of all, what are the criteria going to be for getting rid of an MP, however you do it, whatever the vote is? Are you going to do it because somebody's drunk? Are you going to do it because they've been bent? Well, that seems, I think most of us would agree to that if they've been on the take. Or are you going to be able to get rid of them because you don't agree with them? Because you don't agree with them on Europe, because the swivel-eyed loonies in... No, I mean, not that all anti-Europeans are swivel-eyed loonies, but some of them are, or any other subject, want to get rid of a particular MP because they don't agree with him.
When you
and
say
I
who
don't
is...
think, I don't think that that should happen. I think that is a great risk. And I would have thought that there's a fairly straightforward case for saying you get rid of them if they have been on the take... for instance, as we've seen, some people seem to have been in the last few days. But otherwise, I think probably the voters have to wait until there is a general election on the sort of Burkean principle, who said he was, I am not the member of Bristol, I'm a member of the House of Commons.
Douglas. Well, of course, Edmund Burke showed that he regarded with great suspicion the views of the good people of Bristol, and a few years later they promptly threw him out of office.
Which is fair enough.
Which is what democracy is for. That's how a parliamentary democracy works. The MP is elected to serve a full term.
Indeed, but the problem is we have a system in this country where 7 out of 10 seats are safe. And on the date of the general election, most constituents will be making a macro decision about who they want to run the country rather than who they want to represent them. And because of this, a lot of MPs who some might say are pretty third rate, are able to retain tenure.
Now, Douglas, you are smearing two groups of people there. First of all, MPs and safe seats. I mean, that rather implies that the mediocre can just scrape by without really having to...
Well, hang on. As a good centre-right free market newspaper, I'm sure the Daily Telegraph fully understands the importance of choice and competition in driving up standards. Choice and competition drive up standards in the newspaper business. It's because we have choice and competition.
But we also have to trust the consumers. Inferring from what you're saying that people will not vote a scandal-ridden MP out. And that's not true, because Neil Hamilton did lose his seat in 1997, even though that was a very safe seat.
Indeed, but we need to increase the amount of choice and competition in our political system. Now, of course, you know, we have the Westminster SW1 grandee view, which is that, you know, vexatious attempts will be made to unseat people. Well, let's just look at countries where they have a right of recall triggered by people. Do you see the Californian mob throwing out people with whom they disagree? On the contrary, in California, in nearly 100 years of having a recall, how many times has a recall succeeded?
Five times.
Average, once every two decades. Not once has the recall actually been effectively used against a federal level politician.
Although it did give California Arnold Schwarzenegger as an alternative government.
This idea that, you know, Nick Clegg used the word a kangaroo court. You know, this idea that, you know, we can't trust the people because a mob might come and vexatiously remove a sitting MP. If we couldn't trust the good sense of ordinary folk, we would never have had a jury system in this country on the basis that we would have said juries were unable to make a decision because they would have been prejudiced as to what they thought the law should be rather than what it is. I mean, it's a nonsense. It's an absolute anti-democratic nonsense.
Sue?
Well, I don't agree with that. I think that it is not, just apart from anything else, I don't think it is practical to have the public constantly asked, which might well happen if it were done for vexatious reasons, would you like to get rid of your MP? They should vote every 5 years or whatever it is.
I speak as someone
and it seems to me that there is a real risk that people would get manipulated. I mean, imagine UKIP is on the up and up, as we know, at the moment. Imagine Nigel Farage, for instance, or UKIP managed to get a seat where, or managed to infiltrate, as it were, a seat where there was a lot of anti-European feeling, and they said, what you need to do, good people of Borchester, is to get rid of your local MP because he's not representing your views. And then they get a recall. Well, and I think that there is a real danger with mass media.
We would never have elections for fear that, you know, some unspeakable, ghastly party would win seats. I mean, I think we all agree that we should have a democracy. And, you know, you can have some pretty unspeakable parties standing. But, you know... If you trust the people generally choose good people and make wise choices. You know, these anti-democratic arguments that, you know, we can't trust the people, I'm afraid they just don't stack up.
But you just said you've got mediocre people in all these 7
we don't
out
have
of
enough
10
choice and competition.
Safe seats.
We don't have enough
I mean,
choice and competition.
You can't have it both ways. Either the people choose good MPs or else they don't. But they've always had some bad ones.
Of course. Always. A man is fallen. You always get some people who don't live up to high standards. But, you know, I just find it extraordinary that in 2013 there are people who genuinely and seriously say we cannot trust constituents to make the final choice as to whether an MP should remain.
Well, it isn't necessarily about trusting constituents so much as worrying that the process becomes unwieldy and bizarre. I mean, I think what Sue's saying is what if in seats someone could just go around with a petition, collect enough signatures and trigger a ballot? Okay. How would your system prevent that sort of thing happening?
Let's talk specifics. We've had in this country a recall vote. It is not conventionally thought of as a recall vote, but it was a judicially sanctioned recall. In 1997, the Tories lost Winchester by 2 seats, and they went running to the courts, and they got a judge to say, let's rerun the system and have a recall. So having lost the seat by 2, because they were seen as vexatious crybabies, they were punished by the good people of Winchester, who returned the Liberal Democrat in that second ballot with a majority of 22,000. If you look at states in America where they have a right of recall, again and again, attempts to vexatiously unseat MPs are punished by voters. You know, the idea that we cannot trust the voters to make a rational distinction between who they voted for on election day and whether or not the person that won that ballot is up to the job, you know, it's deeply patronising.
OK, well, let's all presume we can trust the voters, especially those who have the decency to buy the Telegraph. Is the issue not then that we can't trust the politicians and the political class? Sue, Norman Tebbit wrote earlier this week for us that the problem wasn't so much the system as the kind of people who are attracted to it and then exploit it. If you're, I presume if you're sceptical about recalls, is the issue for you the fact that there are such a large number of bad people in Parliament? Is that the problem?
Well, I don't think there's anything you can do about bad people, not least because there have always been large numbers of bad people in Parliament, depending what your definition of bad is. I mean, our history is absolutely littered with corrupt MPs. If you go back roughly 100 years, I mean, look at Lloyd George, who was selling peerages. Go back further and you have rotten boroughs where people could just buy their seats.
Still do.
Well, indeed we might, but I mean, it was much more overt in those days. And you had a patronage system, which indeed I'm sure Douglas would say rightly we still do to some extent. You know, if you play your cards right, you might get into the House of Lords. If you make a big donation to party funds, I mean, nothing to do with you going to the House of Lords, but you're just the kind of chap, if you've got a big enough wallet, that we'd like to see in the House of Lords.
If politics has always attracted those sorts of people, then why is it only recently that we've become so conscious of them? Why have we only recently become aware of them?
I think partly it's because the media sometimes uncovers them, but I don't think we have just become aware of it. I think in the past, depending when you're talking about, it was a much more closed system. The elite could get on and look after itself to a much greater extent. But I mean, Lloyd George did get caught. And one of his sidekicks went to prison, and we have an Anti-Corruption Act, which I think has never been used, once.
We still do have a system in Westminster that is based on sort of deferential democracy that tends to sort of favour the toadies and encourages toadiest behaviour. But, you know, I let's not get carried away. I don't think MPs, in terms of their character and personality, are necessarily any better or any worse than any other 650 people that you picked off the street at random.
I agree.
I think what the behaviour of MPs today and in the past shows is that wherever you have an unaccountable exercise or concentration of power, you will get bad behaviour. Mm-hmm. So the answer has surely to be to increase the accountability. Now, you asked, why is it that people are beginning to not tolerate behaviour that perhaps in the past we turned a blind eye to? I think it's actually the democratizing effect and the shift in the culture brought about by the internet. In the short time that I've been an MP, I've noticed that not only has the internet made me hyper accountable, but the expectations from constituents have risen. I'm expected to account for how I vote, account for what I do in Westminster in a way that simply wouldn't have crossed my mind 10 years ago. I think this is a good thing, actually. We don't see it with politicians. I think we're moving to an age where there's a sort of hyper-accountability for all institutions. This is bad news for anywhere where there's an unaccountable concentration of power, whether it's bankers fixing LIBOR rates, allegedly, whether it's journalists, perhaps not this newspaper, but other newspapers engaging in certain practices.
Yeah.
Wherever there are unaccountable concentrations of power, we're beginning to see change. This is a good thing.
But those unaccountable concentrations of power also do attract certain kinds of people. And it has to be said that you're unusual, Douglas, but a great number of people in Parliament don't seem like real people. I mean, your own leader, our own Prime Minister, is someone who worked effectively as a lobbyist for many years. I mean, I'm not questioning his ethics or anything, but this is a person who went straight from university into politics, was essentially in Westminster his whole life. Is that not the problem, that it's attracting only people from a certain class and perspective?
Because of the way that the party system works, we've got this 2.5 party system, which I'm glad to say is beginning to die on its feet. But because we've had a system where, you know, you've got these 7 out of 10 safe seats, you know, 21st century version of rotten boroughs, you tend to have attracted, and the system tends to have rewarded, people who start very early in politics, who learn the secret code to become a candidate in a winnable seat. It's not a very open system. It's not a very open source system. It's who you know and who you toady up to, rather than how effective you are at articulating and representing the views of constituents that tends to count. Now, because of this, also incidentally, because of the way that the executive and the party system totally dominate Parliament and control Parliament, often in order to be so-called promoted to become a spokesman or minister for widgets, you almost have to have demonstrated that you're incapable of original thought.
Now, right.
These are problems.
Right. I think that, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you've said, but I think two things. I think, first of all, the fact that we have a very narrow entry system into Parliament, increasingly, you know, you become a researcher, then you become a special advisor, next thing you're Chancellor of the Exchequer and you're still only 25. But I don't think that is necessarily connected in any way to whether or not you're bent, whether you're on the take. I mean, I think you get people who are on the take in all walks of life.
Sure, but I don't think there seems to be some sort of link. I was talking about the extent to which there's a sort of a closed shop in Westminster, where people who tended to be special
and
advisors
talk in a certain code.
Yeah, yeah. In a certain code, they accept certain outlooks.
Well, what is the code?
In no way am I suggesting that explains. Yeah.
But what is the code that people talk in? What do you mean when you say people talk in a certain code?
Well, listen to a lot of MPs on Question Time. Often, if you listen on the radio to what's being said, it's sometimes difficult to differentiate, between the different front bench positions. In discussing public policy, there needs to be a broad spectrum of opinion and a constant attempt to challenge the consensus. But on so many issues, take for example energy policy, or until very recently our approach to immigration, or until recently ideas about the extent to which the state should tax and spend. There was an orthodoxy in Westminster that just simply didn't reflect the spectrum of opinion within the country. And I think this is a symptom of the extent to which the political process in Westminster has been hijacked by a narrow clique of career politicos. Now, we can change.
Including in your party?
In all 2.5 parties. Absolutely. I mean, I'm not saying anything that hasn't been said before. It's pretty clear, I think, that if you look at the system we have, it is not as democratic as we pretend it is, and it's not as democratic as it should be. Why is it that in a safe Tory seat, the voters should have as their MP someone who retains the confidence of the whips and of a few hundred local people who are party members, but not perhaps a broader chunk of people who want to be represented by somebody who is accountable to them not to the Westminster system.
I think that's that you're going into a sort of a kind of system, or you sound as if you are, which is quite unfeasible. I mean, it's just not workable.
Direct
you
democracy would never work.
You can't have referendum. Well, I don't think referendums on everything all the time. Charles II would have been a long way from either of us, I think. I don't believe that there are all that many ideas out there, all that many policies that are just waiting to be captured. I mean, most of them, people already have discussed.
Well,
I don't believe there's a huge plethora of doable ideas, if only there were, but I don't think there is.
Perhaps the country's in the state it is because we haven't had the public policy dynamic that a mature, sensible democracy should have.
Douglas Carswell and Sue Cameron, thank you both very much. Nick Ross has caused a storm by saying that it's natural to be curious enough to look at child porn just to, quote, see what all the fuss is about. Well, the fuss, Mr. Ross, is that it involves the sexual abuse of children, and it's shocking to think that such images can be easily downloaded over the internet. The Culture Secretary Maria Miller has called a meeting of various internet chiefs to say enough is enough and to demand that they make it harder to access this filth. But is it really that simple to do? Let's start by addressing the issue of why people might look at child porn. Jake Wallace-Simons, is it natural to be curious?
Well, I think that what Nick Ross said was really quite outrageous. I mean, the tone of his remarks were such that he expected that it would resonate with people. He said that it was natural to be curious. You might find yourself clicking around, and there's a link for child porn, and you know it'll be natural to click on it. And he said that people, does this mean that we're all awful? I think not, is what he said.
Right.
Well, I think a lot of the majority of people would respond by saying, actually, I probably wouldn't click on a link that said, come here for child porn. I might have a certain sort of degree of morbid curiously in my personality.
And the phrase to find out what all the fuss is about is extraordinary, as if you're looking at the website of the EDL or something.
Yes, well, exactly. And the suggestion of what he's saying is that your sense of curiosity will be stronger than your sense of repugnance.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I know, speaking personally, any curiosity that I might have had would be greatly kind of smothered and suppressed by my feeling of horror and repellence against that sort of material.
Okay. But what exactly is this material, Willard Fox, and what are we talking about when we talk about child pornography?
Well, I think the bulk of it, and this gets to the heart of Nick Ross's comments, is that these are images of rape being filmed. And there's no two ways about that. These people can't consent, the children in the image. So almost by definition, these are images of rape. And even when it's these images that have been produced by gangs abusing teenagers and so on and so forth, these girls aren't choosing to do this. This is just rape on film. And no, I'm not curious about it. And frankly, I think it suggests that Mr. Ross has got a pretty interesting internet browser history.
Okay. We don't want to speculate about that. But what about this concept of it being a gateway, it being part of a process? Looking at one type of porn might lead on to another. I mean, is there something to that?
Yes, I mean, that was the point that was made by John Carr, the government advisor on child protection, where he said that if you're looking at a perfectly legal hardcore porn site, other adverts might pop up saying, come this way, for something that's barely legal. I think that's one of the code words that paedophiles use. I think that there is a spectrum here, and perhaps it's in a way similar to the process of radicalisation, in that you might start off with a little bit of curiosity about it, which most people might not share, and then once you start going down the rabbit hole, it might lead to something more and something more, and you'll find out that there's a community of paedophiles who are all interested in this, and you might feel, actually, maybe I'm not abnormal. There are other people like me, and it becomes normalised.
Right.
And I think that what John Carr was saying is that if there is a block, a default block on pornography that you would have to opt into, which would make you aware that there might be legal repercussions if you were to click on something that you shouldn't, that might help people to not become radicalised in a way.
On all pornography. So if anyone wants to look at something obscene on the internet, what will happen when they try and do that?
As I understand it, a sort of a pop-up would appear saying you would need to register and opt in to view pornography.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't say this explicitly, but I would suggest that in that little blurb that it gives you, it would say quite clearly that some of this stuff might land you up in court.
Willard, that sounds like a very good idea.
I think it sounds like a terrible idea,
really,
actually.
Why?
Well, first of all, these blocks are incredibly blunt tools. So, I mean, quite often this will end up blocking things like sexual health advice. It will end up blocking things like forums about perfectly legitimate topics like homosexuality, lesbianism, especially advice for teenagers and things like that. We've even had cases where mobile phone operators are blocking things like satire because they're worried about the legal consequences of it and things like that. Where people have tried this, like in New Zealand, these default porn blocks. What it blocks is a tremendous amount of perfectly legal material, and it doesn't block the hardcore material because the hardcore material just doesn't exist on the internet as a pop-up in the way I think people are suggesting. And this is very much hidden in the sort of dark side of the internet, which you need special tools and quite a lot of tech savvy to get to. It's almost impossible to kind of accidentally stumble onto real child porn. I mean, there's the example in the Daily Mail recently where someone was watching, thought they were watching child porn, but
Amanda
when they actually
Patel.
Checked Amanda Patel, and they actually checked through, and it was, everyone was legal and above board. And, a sort of a 30-year-old woman in a schoolgirl outfit, I don't think there's, maybe I'm alone in this, but I don't think there's any danger that that's a gateway drug almost. I think...
Oh, but what Jake is saying, if it's part of a spectrum, is that actually it could be doing exactly that. If it's making the mind sort of used to those images, is it not setting you up for harder stuff?
Well, I think the radicalisation analogy is actually a good one, but in the same way as radicalisation, you've got to understand the scale of this. I mean, you're talking about in the UK, there are 55,000 children who are under supervision orders and so on, but the bulk of that is down to neglect. So you're talking about a tiny minority within a tiny minority, and these communities are very small. Worldwide, you're talking about probably under a couple of thousand individuals. And that's the scale of the problem. It's really not that big because, as we've discussed in this room, the vast bulk of people, when even there's a hint that that might be the image coming up, you don't want to click on it. You are repelled by the idea of watching a child be raped.
Yeah, but as with all crime, a vast majority of people don't want to commit murder. They don't worry us. What worries us is the small minority of people who do. Therefore, we write our laws in order to dissuade those people from doing it.
But Tim, we could prevent all murder by putting everyone in straitjackets. We could prevent all rape by castrating everyone. The point is, if you want to do a blanket punishment across society and say no one is allowed to look at porn on the internet without clicking through all of these filters and so on, what is the impact of that going to be on society widely? I think it's going to be negative because I think it's going to block a lot of perfectly reasonable, perfectly rational material. And what is the impact going to be on the people we want to stop? And the answer to me seems to be it's not going to really impact them at all because that isn't... First of all, seeing a legal warning isn't going to stop these people. They already know it's wrong. Part of the radicalisation process, part of talking on those forums is all about understanding how to access this material illegally.
Jake.
Well, I mean, I think one of the impacts it will have is probably on Google's revenue, since 30% of online traffic is connected to porn. Mm. I think perhaps that goes some way towards explaining Google's reluctance to actually engage with this problem. We're not talking about a blanket ban or a block. We're talking about a process. It's like an alert. It comes up and says, "Do you want to have a look at this stuff? Are you aware of the consequences?" And if you say yes, then you can go through. And I, in terms of restricting other websites about sexual health and so on. I don't think that's a difficult problem to overcome. I think you can have certain keywords which are linked to legitimate sites which don't trigger this block. And finally, the final point I'd like to make is that you're right that the very worst stuff is going to be hidden away in the dark corners of the internet, that you need to have a certain amount of technological knowledge to be able to access. But people aren't born with that knowledge. People go and seek it out. They develop an appetite for it in legitimate websites, stoke the fires, stoke the flames, begin to get involved and interact with paedophile communities, and then they get the knowledge that allows them to access that darker stuff. And if we address it early on, just like with radicalisation, if you address it early on, there's much more of a chance of nipping this in the bud, and the problem is too serious not to address.
Two points to rebut that. First of all, the fact is that this material is in the legitimate, quote, websites are incredibly hard to stop. First of all, simulated child pornography is a constitutionally protected thing in the US.
So in the US?
In the US,
but not in the UK?
Not in the UK, no, but this makes it incredibly
hot. In fact, Mark Bridger had pictures of that sort on his phone.
But it's incredibly difficult to block access to those sites. And secondly, the other issue is we already have this system in place. The government already has a system called CleanFeed, and when the police find a site that access needs to be blocked to, it is already blocked. And I think the ISPs, I think the search engines are doing almost everything they can, and it's incredibly difficult. I mean, I wrote a piece about this where I talked about the code words they use. They aren't, no one is typing in images for child porn XXX, they're typing in particular code phrases for particular acts, and those make it much harder to...
In that piece, I mean, you mentioned the word hobby that they use as a sort of a pseudonym. I don't quite buy that, because if I type in the word hobby, don't tell me that I'm going to automatically find lots and lots of child porn. I'm going to find lots of other links to
hobby. But
if
you type in hobby plus several other words,
and those are the things that are the things that you can target. You can target long tail combination keyword searches, and I think that we're talking about doing something to address a very serious problem. The search engines, you said they're doing almost as much as they can. We need to know that they're doing as much as they can, not just almost as much as they can. I mean, at the moment, there are 60,000 people in the UK who are swapping and downloading images of porn. And some people have suggested that between 1 in 6 and 1 in 10 of these will at some point act out these fantasies. This is serious stuff, and we need to be doing everything we can and more to prevent this from snowballing.
And if you know some of the words, I'm not saying you personally know it, but if people can find out what these words in combination are, why aren't the police chasing this down? I don't understand. If there are these code words, if it is known, why, working with the search engines, the police can't clamp down on
it? It works in exactly the same way as radicalisation. And the first thing the police and the security services will tell you about radicalisation is they don't want the forums closed down, because they monitor the forums, and they use them to gather intelligence. They don't, and when they close a forum down, they then have to go looking again to find the intelligence. So the security services, certainly I've talked to, don't want the radicalisation forums closed down. They want it in a place where they can look and they can monitor. So it's not just as simple as we close these down, the problem goes away. These people's urges remain, and it's how do you deal with it? And perhaps the American attitude of saying these urges will always exist, and maybe we should allow them access to simulated child pornography legally, is perhaps a better way of doing it.
Oh, well, my goodness. No, I'm sorry. That's an absolutely appalling idea. That's grotesque. The idea that we would somehow feed, we would sate the appetite of a monster by allowing them access to simulated images. I mean, we're effectively condoning what is not a natural perversion by any means, is a self-willed, self-determined, utter evil.
I totally agree, but the thing about it is you've got to ask yourself the question, how do we deal with the problem? And dealing with the problem doesn't mean we pass it off to Google. It's you've got to look at it completely holistically.
But Google have got to be a big part of it. I mean, I think the tone of it, the tone of your argument, is something that I worry about, because I think to argue in defence of doing nothing, because it's difficult and because there are technological challenges and legal challenges, it seems to me to be acting in defence of something that's rather evil. I think we should be looking at a goal of trying to clamp down on it more and taking that as our direction of travel.
Jake Wallace-Simons and Willard Foxen, thank you both very much. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.